Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.
Hello and welcome back to Ringside Rewind with me, Tris Dixon, joined as always by Ian Dark and John Rawling, two of the voices of boxing. Although actually John Rawling might not have much of a voice today because he's fighting the New Year ailments, as it were. But we are joined with one of the British boxer, or one of boxing's greats, really, the Hall of Famer himself, Barry McGuigan. Barry, thank you so much for taking the time to join us. We go back about 20 years, I think, you and I, but you go back even further with these gents. Ian, do you remember the first time you met Barry?
Yeah, it was covering his fights in Belfast when he was on the way up, and he had so much charisma, such a big following, and you knew it was a wonderful story. But let's hone in straight away, Barry, shall we, on that massive night at Queen's Park Rangers, June the 8th, I think it was, 1985, you against Eusebio Pedrosa, who I think was making his 20th defense of the title, a really good fighter. I think he was the longest reigning world champion in all the weights at the time. What are your memories looking back on that now? You must look at the tape from time to time.
Well, it was a different time, Ian. You remember we were on the BBC, you were with the BBC and John as well. So it was huge stuff, and you were on Sports Night in the middle of the week, and then you had a Saturday night, and this was a Saturday night fight, obviously. It was a big build-up, and things were very nasty in Northern Ireland at the time. It was really a very, very tough time. You know, when you're a young fella and you're training every day and you see the army and you walk into guys with machine guns every day and you see them and you meet with them and everything else, you become accustomed to that. But the tension was really dreadful in there. And I made a decision not to get involved in any way. And I kept the peace thing going. And I deliberately sort of navigated my way down that route. And bear in mind, I'm an Irishman from the south of Ireland fighting for the British and European title and now for the world title. And, I was boxing, and it's interesting, Ian and John, maybe you're probably aware that this was one of the first fights, if not the first fight that BBC done live. Yeah. They showed Ali and Cooper and all of that stuff beforehand and Conte and all, but that was all filmed, edited, and then put out. This was the first show they ever done live, and they took a real gamble on it. And it paid off magnificently. We had 25,000 people there. The atmosphere was incredible. It took forever to get to the ring because people wanted to slap me on the back and all of that sort of stuff. And it was at QPR. It was right beside the broadcasting house. So it was just an amazing night. And 12,000 Irishmen flew across from Dublin and Belfast. It was just like a huge, huge thing. And, it was remarkable. And I just tried to... used to calm things down and just say, right, it's just another fight. And I had to keep telling myself that because it was really huge. It was massive. And then to get an audience of almost 19 million people watching it on the television was, when you think about that nowadays, it's remarkable. It's just incredible. And going to the ring was chaos, trying to, because people wanted to slap me, and most of the guys had been drinking all day, and all the previous fights didn't really matter, so coming to the ring was great, and then getting into the fight, and then of course my dad sang Danny Boy, which was our national anthem, because we didn't want to sing the Soldier Song. We didn't want to sing the Queen. We didn't want to alienate people or divide people. We wanted people to come together. So Danny Boy was, and I know they played it at the Commonwealth Games, but we sort of owned it, that, and Dad getting up and singing, my own father, and he was nervous as hell because of me. And he sang all the time in the show band era. And he was hugely popular, and he represented Ireland in the Eurovision Song Contest. But this was a huge occasion. And so for him, he was nervous for me, so it was tough for him. But it was great. It was phenomenal. And I remember standing in the ring, and I used not to listen to the words of the song because it's an emotive song. So I looked across the ring, and Dermot slapped the ring and said, "Barry, he's staring at you." So I sort of moved away, and you'll actually see me. I look across the ring at Pedroza, who's sort of trying to wind me up, and I just stare at him, smile at him, and then, you know, within a few minutes, then there was this little guy doing tumbling around the ring that Barney decided would be a great idea, and then he would throw this green dust at Pedroza and in some way spook him. It was phenomenal. And then before we knew it, the bell had gone and the fight started. It was a great night, and it was a great fight. And he was a great champion. I tried my best to get rid of him. I hurt him in the sixth, had him out on his feet in the ninth, wobbled him in the 13th, tried again. And I remember the bell for the 15th round going out and thinking, I'm not going to get rid of this guy. And so on. Just, I boxed to the end. I just moved my head and spun around and used my boxing skills. But it was it was a phenomenal night, and I'll never forget it. And, you know, and then to go on and win BBC Sports Personality of the Year, and not many fighters have done that. So it was pretty special.
It was an electrifying night. I mean, I think one of the most electrifying I've ever been involved in. I remember how long it took you to get to the ring. I was doing the BBC radio commentary.
Okay, I was going to say that to you, yeah.
Yeah, 19 million, I think. Yeah, that was right. That was the TV audience. And I remember it was much earlier than usual for big fights. It was like 8 o'clock in the evening, wasn't it? It was almost still light.
It was early. It had just gone dark. And, yeah. The atmosphere, and I remember coming in, and we tried to get in because there was a crowd of people right back out to Shepherd's Bush, and so we drove the van in, and Barney decided to put Barry McQuicken on the side of the truck, on the side of the transit van, so we had to sort of, we left it late as we could, and then we drove in really quickly, and we got out, and then people just came running at us, like, it was like, it was on the rugby pitch, they came like to scrum with us, but we got in through the door just in time and then ran to the dressing room and got on with it, you know.
Barry, let me ask you this. We're obviously decades removed from this magical night, but it's not really lost anything in history. Like, it's still, people will still hold it up as one of the great nights in British boxing history. Does it still feel fresh and emotive to you when you think about it? You know, even though there's arguably complex on the story now for you.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, I think about it, and I can almost remember every round. I can certainly remember, the critical points in the fight and times. And I remember going out, for example, in round six. And I thought, I'm going to walk him down this round. I'm going to walk into him. And he hit me with so many uppercuts. My jaw was sore and just below both ears. He just kept boom and throwing the uppercuts. And I thought, he's not ready to go yet. So back off and start using your jab. But he was brilliant and slick and dirty on the inside if you could give him the chance. But he'd fouled Laporte 110 times in his defense against him. He was brilliant at fighting at close range, and although he was tall and rangy, and that's kind of what made him uniquely brilliant. 5'9.5" for a featherweight is very tall, and yet he had that long frame and wide shoulders, and he brilliant at close range. And you know, he's the sort of guy that you'd want your kid coming up to spar with and teach them, you know, how to fight on the inside. He was. Exceptional, but I remember it all the time, Tris. Yeah,
tell us about when you had him down, Barry, in the seventh round, was it? Because I rewatched the fight this morning, and Harry Carpenter was saying you know, that he was having one of, Pedroza was having one of his best rounds, yeah. and that you were not able to get into yeah. range. And then you hit him almost from nowhere with that yeah. terrific right hand.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you, John, I remember the same. McGuigan's work has not been so effective in this round. Oh, yes, it is. He's hit him with a right.
Yeah,
and what I was trying to do, I'd been practicing this, and Gerald Hayes had fought Pedroza, and he got beat up in Panama, but he fought him, and he was saying, you know, he's open to the right hand. So I threw the right hand to the body, and I'd been working on that with my brother Dermot, and been working on it in sparring. You throw the right hand and drive it, and put his arm, get him to sort of put his elbow down just to deflect it, and it would sort of create a little bit of a gap. And that's exactly what I did. I went three times, and I went deliberately, and I bent down through the right hand, boom. And he put his elbow in to block it. And then the next one, I showed the body, and I hit him to the head. Didn't really hit him. I hit him high up on the cheekbone, didn't hit him on the chin. And he went down, and he got up again. And then all hell broke loose in the audience, and you couldn't hear anything. I mean, and I immediately took, you know, looked, glanced down at Dermot, and he went, you know, go at him and throw a right hook. So I again ran in and threw a right hand, a right hook, a short right hook, and he pulled his head back and then whistled past him like that. And then I threw a left hook and whistled past him. So I knew he wasn't that badly hurt. He was still okay.
I remember another thing about that night, Barry. You know how we have these dramatic announcements of the results by Michael Buffer yeah. and his life these days. The ring announcer was so excited that you'd won that he didn't go through the normal routine of saying, let's go to the judges' scorecards. I mean, we all thought you'd won. He just blurted it, picked up the mic and blurted out, Barry McGuigan is the world champion. Do you remember
that? I remember it very well, you know. And the winner is Barry McGuigan. And I thought, well, that sort of knackered it a little bit, but you know, he done very well. It was an exciting night, and everybody was just crazed. And it was bonkers, you know.
Barry,
coming home and driving.
Excuse me, Barry, the inventions that night. I mean, I find it amazing that you kept yourself together so well, because even watching it on the television this morning, as I was doing, you know, hearing your dad singing Danny Boy, I was in tears. I don't mind admitting, yeah. There were tears in my eyes as I was watching. And I was thinking, how on earth were you keeping yourself together with the biggest fight of your life, just a matter of a minute or two away?
But you know, John, that was why I kept myself together. That was why, because I knew it, you know, as much as I would never listen to the words of the song. And that's why it's almost like Dermot knew what to do. And he said, Barry, he's staring, he's giving you the death stare, look across the ring. So I was taking my mind off the, you know, you think about it, you know, with all that emotion and that's in that song and what it means, particularly to, you know, the Londonderry area to, and what was going on there at that time, it was terrible. So, you know, I couldn't allow myself to be emotional. I just couldn't do it. And so therefore I would blank it out and just block it out and just think, well, I've got a job to do here. And even when I hurt him in the seventh, and he went down, I knew the way he reacted. I was still very cognitive and aware of what was going on and how I could so easily have been nailed with a counter and hurt myself. So I knew I had to be switched on. I knew I had my job to do. And I was only 24, like, but I still, I knew that I had a big fight on my hands, you know.
Barry, you were a beacon of light. You said, I mean, they were very gloomy, troubled times in Northern Ireland with murder, riots, and you very steadfastly were a unit force and didn't get involved in that. I think you wore a United Nations flag, did you, on your shorts, that world title fight against Pedroza. So my question to you is, how difficult, even dangerous, was it to maintain that stance?
Well, it I've got to be careful what I say here, because we're now sort of 37 years removed, but it's, you know, there's peace over there at the moment, but it's relative peace, and it's, you never know when things can kick off again. And but looking back on, I mean, it's over the last sort of 25 years in Northern Ireland, things have been, there's been peace. So, but at that time, it's very hard to articulate what it was like at that time. But it was very, very, a very, very scary place.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to bring, I just wanted to make, you know, several nights of the year entertaining for the people. And I had a phenomenal support from both sides. And it was scary. It was very scary. And bear in mind, I lived, I just moved out of Clonus. Clonus is a border town, my hometown. And I moved literally 500 yards over the border and built a house so that could be close to my mom and dad, close to my family. And yet I was still living in the UK, as it were. But there was tension, dreadful tension, and lots of murders along the border, and lots of, a very scary time, very difficult time. So I did my best to bring people together, but there would have been an element of hostility towards me from, you know, the hardened Republicans and the hardened loyalists. But to be perfectly honest, I didn't give a damn about them. I didn't worry about them. And I was young and my life was going 100 miles an hour. And so therefore, but you know, you could feel it in certain places where you would go that, you know, you weren't really welcome. You could feel that. And there was no doubt about that. But, you know, that's fine. I was able to cope with it. And then, of course, there was a genuine threat, and the authorities were warned that they were going to lift me. And if you remember, there were a number of judges and politicians that were taken and Shergard, you remember? They were never seen again. And there were ransoms and all that sort of stuff. So we knew it was very serious. So I had a 24-hour support and care. I mean, when I was in the north, there were two guys 50 yards behind me with Rugers and guns. And in the south, I had two guys that were watching me everywhere I went as well. They're just a couple of steps behind me with tooled up. So it was a scary, dangerous time. But
it's amazing, Barry, because you were so young. You said there, 24, obviously, for Pedroza, yeah. Young, you know, you're so young to have this burden and these pressures on your shoulders. And I mean, you kind of obviously explained it a moment ago when you said, you know, you were young and almost kind of footloose and fancy free. But this, the responsibility on your shoulders is so unique.
Well, it was frightening, and it was, and then, you know, when I was doing loads of personal appearances, and so anytime I went to wherever I went, the guys had to go with me, so they would follow me to anything I was doing in the north, and anything I was doing in the south, the two guys would follow me in the south, and I'm still very friendly with the guy from the south, funnily enough, who used to be my sort of armed guard, as it were. So he's now retired from the police, but he was from the Garda. But he was one of the special branch guys, and you know, it was a very serious time. It was a very, very worrying time. But you know, I only thought, you know, I'm going to do my best to entertain people. I'm not going to get involved in politics. I'm not going to be swayed to wear this or wear that. And that, I think, there was so much stuff going on that they wanted me to the RA would have wanted me to be make a statement for them, but I didn't want to get involved in any of that, and I wouldn't do it, and so that pissed off a certain group of people, but to be perfectly honest, I didn't care about them. I was only interested in the fans, and I had phenomenal support. Really amazing support. And then there was a first defense in the King's Hall against a really exceptional fighter in Bernard Taylor. And then I got him out of there after 8 rounds. And then it was the second defense against Danilo Cabrera in Dublin. Mm. And we wanted to fight in Dublin because there was mad support down there as well. And it was crazy. Really was crazy.
That was quite a tough fight, wasn't it?
He turned out to be a very tough guy, and he was a very durable guy, and he was in shape. He was getting ready for a South American title fight, And you know, we had this Argentinian guy who Sosa, who pulled out because he got a damaged hand or something, and then he was to fight me again in Vegas when I lost the title, and he got a detached retina. And Daniel Cabrera came in at the last minute, but very tough kid, South American champion, as I say, and was getting ready to defend his title. So he was in shape, and when he got the green light, he was delighted and came over to Dublin. Tough, durable guy, awkward. He had this unusual bouncy sort of style, and he was tough as nails, and I nailed him and had him out twice or three times, and there was a referee, and I remember he was a guy from Florida called Ron Eckett, and and he was terrible. He's just a terrible referee. He should have stopped the fight. Again, say that again.
Never to be heard of again, I don't think.
No, he didn't stop the fight. It went on and dragged on, and I got cut on both eyes, and it was a bit of a messy performance, but I got him out of there eventually in the 13th round.
Barry, do you remember any of your early dealings with either of these two learned gentlemen?
Yes, I remember Ian. Was it Radio 2 at the time of the Pedroza fight?
Yeah, I mean, I used to go. You mentioned there the atmosphere in Belfast. I mean, because of all the reports on a daily basis of all the troubles, I was frightened to death. To be honest, go to Belfast to cover your fights. And one of the things I had to do was, like, we didn't always have the commentary rights. We did on some of them, like the Laporte fight, one or two of the others. Other times I'd just have to go there, and then I'd have to go to Broadcasting House in Belfast, you know, at the end of the night's boxing. So now it's getting on for midnight. I send this piece over, you know, I do a voice piece and a few interviews and that kind of thing, send the interview with you down to London. And then I'd have to walk through the streets of Belfast back to the Europa Hotel. It's only about 300 yards.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to the guy on the door one night, I'm leaving, I said, I'm going to be all right. And I'm just walking down to the Europa Hotel. He goes, no problem at all. No problem at all. Up you go. You'll only take you a couple of minutes. Yeah. I got about 50 yards up the road. And this is Belfast humor, I'm guessing. He shouts after me, but mind how you go.
Yeah, that's typical Belfast humor, but also just how good is your Belfast accent? You don't want to be speaking like that in the mid 80s as you're walking back to the Europa Hotel. Well, the most bombed hotel of all time, by the way. You know that? It was the most bombed hotel of all time.
Yes, yes, it was, wasn't it? I think it was bombed 32 times, wasn't it? Yeah, we all stayed there.
Including us at around fight time, and most of our because it was the Hastings group who owned that, and Barney Eastwood had a great relationship with the old guy Willie Hastings, and so we had the Stormont Hotel, and we had the Europa, and then you had the one out at along the estuary near Barney Eastwood's place. So it was the Culloden. So it was the Hastings group. So I do remember, and I remember also, Ian, didn't you do my 1978 fight against the Tumat Sugolik in the Commonwealth Games, the final?
No,
was that not you?
No, I came in a couple of years after that. That was probably Desmond Lynham.
Des Lynham did it. That's right, Des Lynham did. But I wasn't sure whether he did the radio, correct? And then Harry Carpenter did the television. And Harry wasn't convinced that it was a close fight, but Dez thought I had won, which was so. I think he had a slightly better better view from my perspective than Harry did. But it was a tough fight, and I don't think I ever got hit that hard. I got hit twice where I didn't know where I was. And that was against Tumat Sugolik, this Papua New Guinean guy, built like he looked the size of a lightweight. And remember in the amateur days, you'd go to the ring, and so it'd be lightweights and then bantamweights. And then you'd have featherweights and like welterweights. And I'm walking to the ring, and I look across, I see this guy, and I think, oh, that's a light welterweight. So I get to the ring, and next thing he pops into the ring. I went, hold on a second, they've got the wrong guy. He looked huge. He was massive. Anyway, so he hit me in the second round, and boy, he absolutely knew. He took my head off. That was the hardest I ever got hit. And then the second time that happened was against Laporte, and you were there that night in the eighth round. He hit me. Whoa. And I thought I was in my mother's shop, and so honestly, he I thought I was wandering around my mother's shop, thinking, "What am I doing? What am I doing here?" But I got through it. Yeah, it was tough.
That was like the semi final, wasn't it? Ahead of the big world title. Yeah, that was one where we all went away saying, "Hey, that was a heck of a performance. This guy's really got a chance of becoming the world champion." I mean, I don't know what you think. It seemed to be a view among the fight reporters at the time that maybe that was your absolute peak that night against
you. I think from a purely performance point of view and an entertaining fight, that I don't think I ever fought better than that. It was only 10 rounds, of course, but we fought at a ferocious pace, and I knew the way to fight him. I knew not to give him any time, because if you're lazy with, or you know you're in and out movement, and try to outbox Laporte. He hit so hard that he knocked out so many guys. I mean, he knocked out Jeff Mayweather, and he knocked out Rocky Lockridge, and he was such a devastating puncher. And I knew not to do that, and I knew just to stay on him. So from a purely performance point of view, if you look at that fight, it was nonstop, from bell to bell. Yeah. And it went 10 rounds, and I don't think I ever performed better than it, including the Pedroza fight. The occasion, the atmosphere and everything else in Loftus Road was, and because of what it meant to the Irish people and to me and to the British audience, it was probably... that was a bigger event, but a pure boxing performance, I don't think I ever fought better than I did against Laporte, and he hit me harder than anybody ever hit me. It was incredible. He really hurt me in that eighth round, but I got through it. My powers of recovery, because I was young and I was driven, and Leonard was there, and the BBC were there. Sugar Ray Leonard was there with NBC. And then they'd done a deal with ABC before the world title fight. So it was a great atmosphere and a great performance, I think.
I mean, Las Vegas and Stevie Cruz was a big event as well, wasn't it? It was a huge event. And, it was sort of your bid to take on or take over America and put a big dent. But was the Cruz fight supposed to lead you to somewhere else? Was it supposed to take you to Azuma Nelson?
Well, I mean, that would have been into I would have gone from there arguably to the super featherweight title, because Alfredo Lane, do you remember who did he fight for the super featherweight title? I can't remember who it was. In any case, if you can get on to Boxrec, you can find out. And he beat Wilfredo Gomez. That's what it was, for the super featherweight title. So I was looking at a fight against Gomez, and of course he went along and spoiled it by beating him. But I would have gone up to super featherweight after that, and so that would have been the next path. And I think probably would have ended, because Nelson, before that had, or shortly after that, had gone up then to super featherweight as well. So that's where we would have ended up, and possibly a fight down the line. But it was a huge setback and a huge disappointment, losing in Vegas,
It was called the triple hitter, wasn't it?
Right.
That bit.
Yeah.
I remember it was you, Roberto Duran, and memory serves, Thomas the Hitman
Hearn. Tommy Hearn, correct.
All the, like a triple headliner. I always remember it was the same week as England being beaten by Argentina in the hand of God goal. I was watching the sports book at Caesar's Palace, doing my interviews with you and Steve Cruz. I remember ringing his room. I don't think anybody really paid much attention to him ever before, because I rang him and said, "I'm from the BBC. Would you do an interview?" And he was like completely overcome. He goes, "You want to interview me? The BBC want to interview me?" I said, "Well, yeah, you're fighting Barry McGuigan in a world title fight. So, there's going to be, well, yeah, when can I do it?" He said.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I mean, obviously it was a fairy tale for him, but from from your point of view, Barry, I mean, you were going to be going up to super feather. You were probably getting a bit tight at featherweight, and of course the heat was incredible, wasn't it?
Well, I injured my ankle in training and all of that. I've got to be careful as to what I say about that, because Barney and I ended up in court over that issue. But I had a substantial injury to my ankle, and preparation just wasn't good for the fight. You know, you never get an ideal preparation. I mean, that's the truth. And nobody is ever, seamless preparation. It just doesn't happen. You always get hiccups here and there, and something happens in camp, whatever. I don't think it could have gone any worse, to be perfectly honest. But you pick yourself up and you just get on with it. But the ankle injury wasn't helpful. And, fighting at that time of the day, they wanted me at that time of the day, because that was from a television eyeballs, it was the right time. They knew that from their evidence in the past. And so just fighting in that type of heat was I always knew it was going to be problematic, hence the reason I was aggressive and tried to get him out of there early on. And then he dropped me in the 10th. Was it the 10th he dropped me? I think he dropped me in the 10th, and I got through it. But I was, I was pretty dilapidated by the championship rounds from 12 to 15. I was pretty much all out. But, I done my best, and I got up and tried to get on with it as best I can. But it was pretty devastating, the whole thing,
We've heard about the heat, Barry, obviously over the years. When you describe that heat, what was it like being in there? Was it suffocating humidity, or was it like almost hot to the skin as soon as you stepped out from behind the curtain?
Yeah, well, it was 120 odd degrees. It's like going into a sauna, really, and going in doing the pads in the sauna. If you try that. and then try sparring. They were successful shows, and they put them on. It was just too hot. It was the wrong time, and I don't think any athlete can perform in those sort of conditions. No matter how hard you try, what you do in the process of training in that sort of conditions, you weaken yourself. Because bear in mind, fighters in the weight categories, anything below cruiserweight, are all fighting weight, and you're struggling to make weight. So to a lesser or greater extent, when you're burning yourself down to a championship weight, it's tough. But then you replenish, and in those days you weighed in at 12 o'clock and you fought at 6 o'clock, and nowadays a featherweight will weigh in on Friday at 12, 2 o'clock, and then he'll have 30 hours before he fights at 10 o'clock the following night. And he'll put on between 14 and maybe 20 pounds in that period of time. And so that's the difference. And you're able to replenish, and, you fill the cerebral spinal fluid up, your brain rehydrates to its full size. There's no room between the skull wall and the brain. And that's why so many of the very devastating injuries that happen in boxing are so devastating, because guys have busted themselves to get down to weight. And even with the 24-hour weigh-in nowadays, people still get injured. We know that that's always possible. But the rehydration issue is a big, big, big thing in boxing. We should drill down on that and try and understand it better.
Let me just ask you one more on this, Barry, then I'll hand you over to John, who I can see is chomping at the bit. There is that famous image of you glassy-eyed and vacant after the Cruise fight, isn't there? Are you know the one I'm referring to, very famous.
Yeah, I think it was around, that was the penultimate round. That was just coming out for the 15th.
Are you realising what's happening and the enormity of what's happening? Are you thinking that you can't turn it round, or are you still hopeful, or are you not at the races any longer?
I think at that stage it was get through the fight, try and win the last round, get through it and try and win the last round. And the interesting thing was, if I hadn't been knocked down in the 15th round, I would have retained my title. I knew I was still ahead, but I also knew I was out of gas. And I was out of gas, as I said. I struggled through the last three rounds. But he knew it more than me. He knew that he was behind, and that he had to. If I'd have been knocked down once instead of twice in the last round, I may have retained my title with a draw. So at that stage, I was just thinking, try and get through the round, try and win the round, and but it just wasn't going to happen. So because I was running on empty for about three rounds, two and a half rounds. But that, that's the game, and you accept that, and that's the way it is. And he had to go through all that, and he was a Tex-Mex, and he lived in San Antonio, which is similar temperature to Vegas, so he had that advantage. Yeah. But I had more experience and blah blah blah. So it all balances up. That's just the way it is, and you got to understand that, and you got to accept that, and I do accept it. It's tough, but I'd like to have, retained my title and then gone to super featherweight and won a title and been able to stay, make several defenses, and then bow out. But it just didn't work out that way, and therefore, as you accept your lot.
And as a fighter, you are never going to be the same again, as time would tell.
Well, I mean, yes, but you lose a little bit of yourself in every tough fight, and that's the reality. We were in, in reference to Trish's book, and you see the guys nowadays, and they're all talking about, and it's something. It's a very, very serious matter, John and Ian and Trish. I mean, I don't have to tell you, but in this day and age, where they're talking about not heading the ball the day before the England team play or whatever, they take a day off heading the ball, and not in any way undermining what has happened to the old players of 1966, and so many of them have got dementia and all of that, with the heavier balls and heading the balls and all that sort of stuff. It is worrying. It is worrying that brain damage is becoming an issue, and it's become a bigger issue now, and it is something that concerns me. But we've got to be very careful, because we take these responsibilities on board when we get into the ring. We understand all that, and it's a very dangerous subject, I think, and it has to be handled very carefully. And I don't know that we can make the game. I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't know how much safer we can make the game. I just don't know how much safer, because there's a very thin line between making it safe and then making it like nobody wants to watch it anymore. So I think we've got to be careful how we deal with that. And we do accept the risks we take when we step into the ring as amateurs and professionals, particularly as professionals. And that goes with the territory. I don't know how you feel about it.
Well, I suppose one of the things, Barry, and this sort of segues into my next question, is when people know it's time to quit, because some of these injuries and some of the long-lasting damage seems to occur for the guys who carry on way too long, mm-hmm. And obviously Muhammad Ali in many ways is a poster boy for that, right? People say, he should have got out before or just after the Ernie Shavers fight, and then maybe things wouldn't have gone downhill so rapidly. Obviously, we weren't aware of those kind of long-term injuries, or CTE wasn't a topic for debate. But what made you think about hanging them up, and how hard was that? Because that's another hot topic in terms of how hard is it to accept that your identity has changed, where you're no longer a fighter, you become an ex-fighter?
Well, I mean, the one thing, kind of like what John was asking me, keeping my cool in the fight against Pedroza, when I had him down, and maybe I could have run in and let things go and walked on to one myself. But I was able to keep my cool and just look at this very pragmatically and sensibly. Everybody has a time limit. Everybody has a shelf life. And particularly in contact sports, whether it's playing rugby, whether it's playing in rugby league, rugby union, and in boxing as well, you have a time where you're at your best. And I always said to myself, as soon as I start to diminish, I'm out of there. And it's not, I'm not, you know, I wasn't I was being selfish from that perspective, because I knew, you know, if you hang around too long, you can get damaged. And, you know, don't keep tempting fate. Don't keep going in there. And then people make loads of excuses and say, oh, I lost all my money and this happened and that happened. And that's the reason I'm coming back. You know, it's a young man's sport. It's a great and phenomenal and most exciting sport in the world. But, you know, you have your time and you have your shelf life. And, you know, get in there, do your thing, and then get out. But I'm not, you know, people don't have the same attitude that I have. And therefore, and people are entitled to their opinion and entitled to do their thing. But it's, you know, get in. And my attitude was always get in there, do your thing. As soon as you start to diminish, get out. And that's what I did. And I could see that it wasn't, you know, in fairness and in all honesty, I could, my brother and I were very close. And we talked about it, and he knew that the magic wasn't there, wasn't as good as it was. You know, I was pretty decent in the comeback fights, but there was a little bit of the magic had gone, and that was what made me a champion. And therefore, I just said, well, I'm not going to be a punch bag for anybody. I'm going to get in, do my thing, and get out.
And you were one of the lucky ones in the sense that there were broadcasting gigs with these two gentlemen to move into. People wanted you, obviously, because you bring so much to the table as an analyst through your experience and obviously being a good talker. So was that an easy transition to make, to go from being in the ring to behind the mic?
Yeah, I mean, it was great. I mean, bear in mind that Ian was ringside with Glenn as opposed to me being in the studio and doing the punditry. But I had done several gigs with John as well. So it was great. And you know, being able to talk about the stuff you love, the things that you did and talk about, you know, the young kids and prospects coming through and all of that. That's a gift, you know, it's lovely. And you know, these two guys were the best in the business. I mean, no question about it. And, you know, I've got to be careful I don't get political, but these guys were outstanding and still are. And you know, they should still be involved. I mean, John is, but Darkie was exceptional.
There's incredible times, weren't they, really? I mean, when we think of all the fights we used to cover and the era we covered, Barry was in the studio. Ahmed, Lennox Lewis, Mike Tyson, De La Hoya, Trinidad. I mean, you could go on. Holyfield, Bo, Baggy. You know, we don't want to make it a mutual admiration society, but, you know, Barry with Jim in the studio and Ian and, you know, me and Glenn at ringside through all that era, it was a privilege and a pleasure, really, you know. And I don't want to, you know, big up Barry too much, but everything he'd been through as a fighter, I think when he spoke about boxing, you listened.
Thank you. It's you know, bear in mind that I had the Young Ali affair, and that was very sad, and it was in the Grosvenor House in 1982. So was it terrible thing? Say again.
How near were you to quitting after the Young Ali tragedy?
Well, you know, I genuinely didn't. I didn't want to continue. But then I sat down with my parents and my girlfriend, and who is now my wife, and said, well, what else can I do? What other things can I do? I've committed so much to boxing that I just... You know, it was a tragedy and everything else. And, you know, I did start the PBA and did try to improve things. And there's no doubt that the pressure that we put on the Board of Control improved the standard of medical care so much. There's no doubt about that. And the 24-hour weigh-in and all of those new things that came on board, anaesthetist ringside, local hospital, and local neurosurgical hospital being aware of fight taking place and all of that. So that all... It happened as a result of the, you know, the pressure that we put on the board and worked with the board. And then, of course, we had Watson, we had McClellan and all of that sort of stuff. So it was great to be able to take that knowledge, you know, and just absorb it all and enjoy it all. And you know, it was great. It was really great. And you know, I worry about the sport. I worry about just it going forward and and what we can do to secure its future, you know.
Did you want Shane to be involved in it in any way, shape or form? I mean, obviously, I know he was a good amateur, a very promising amateur. And obviously now he's got a fantastic career as a trainer. Did you want him to be involved in boxing?
No, because, you know, I'd seen, when I worked with Sky and ITV and Screen Sport and Eurosport and all of that sort of stuff going up and down the country, we've seen loads of father and son teams, that guys that did boxing, their kids coming through and then them boxing. It puts phenomenal pressure on them. And, you know, I just didn't want my kids to box for that reason, because it would always be, oh, you're not as good as your dad, or, you know, mm-hmm. you'll never be as good as your dad. And that's the truth. And so therefore I didn't want him to do it. And then he was down in Millfield, Jake and Shane were down in Millfield, and then he says to me, oh dad, I'm boxing. And I went, what? He says, I'm boxing. I said, what are you doing? And, you know, he'd been going to the local amateur club and then training with the German teacher in above where the swimming, amazing sports facility that had this big place above where the 50-meter swimming pool is. And he's been sparring with the German teacher. So I thought to myself, well, look, now that he's done it, I either get on board, or, you know, I let somebody else train him, and you know, I didn't want that to happen. I wanted to give him the best support I could. And he, you know, he won a couple of national titles. He won the Irish under 21s. He won the Ulster seniors. And he was a very decent fighter. So he then had to make a decision. Either I go in and try and get into the top elite amateurs, or I turn over. And he said, you know, I don't want to be, he was a very pragmatic guy. I don't want to be a burden on my dad. I know how much he would worry about me. So I just, he decided to give it up and do a strength and conditioning course. And he's very, very knowledgeable about, as you know, Tris, because you're into weightlifting and strength training. So he's very, very knowledgeable on that. He done the pads for me one time I was away, and he was straight in, and I just knew he could be very good at it. So that's how it all started for him.
Yeah, well, he became a student of strength and conditioning, didn't he? He was working with the late Charles Poliquin, a hell of an education to get from in terms of that background. And then Barry, one more for me, then I'll leave you to the guys for any final things. But I was obviously there when you were inducted into the International Boxing Hall of Fame. I'm trying to look for an answer here that's not cliche, but how does that compare with winning a world title? Is it up there, or do you think?
Oh, yeah, there's no doubt. Me and Ken Buchanan went out then, and I'm not sure what year it was. We went to Los Angeles to get inducted into the World Boxing Hall of Fame. And then the year I went to Canastota was Bobby Chacon was with me, and the great light middleweight who beat Leonard. What was his name? I can't think of his name.
Terry Norris.
Terry Norris, and he sadly has got a bit of dementia. Yeah. So it was an amazing time, and just to be to be inducted into that is, to my mind, that's the pinnacle. You know, that's it. Being recognized by your peers, and you know, to know that I made an impact and that I'd done something that made an impact on my, you know, my home country and helped in the way we did to bring peace, even for, you know, several nights throughout the Troubles and the special nights. And to be part of that was great. You know, I mean, everything happened too quick in Loftus Road. I didn't really get a chance to appreciate or understand it. But when you're in the International Boxing Hall of Fame, when you get inducted into that, that's really special. You know, that's really special.
The thing with you is you transcended boxing, didn't you? You don't get 19 million people stopping what they're going to do on a Saturday night to see a guy from Belfast fighting for the world featherweight title. And that's what happened. Why do you think you had that charismatic effect? Why you caught the imagination in the way you did?
I know, I just enjoy people. I enjoy conversation. I enjoy meeting people. I enjoy learning about people. And I've always been open and I like people. I like conversing with people, and I enjoy it. And I mean, it was madness, you know, when I would go to these fetes after winning a world title. And Sandy used to say, you can't give everybody 10 minutes, Barry. You just, you'd be there for a week and a half. You know, you got to just say hello and whatever. But I enjoyed talking to people and meeting people and meeting interesting people. And I still am today. And I think that people like, you know, fans like that. You know, I had unbelievable support. It was incredible, and I'm very grateful for it, and I'm very, very thrilled that people, you know, had the time for me to watch me, and you know, dedicated their nights to watching me fight. So that's very special, you know.
Barry, this is, you can confirm or deny if this was a thing. When you talk about conversation and enjoying the English language, I'm sure I heard this from somewhere, but did you read the dictionary every day to learn a word that you didn't know?
I love words and etymology. I love the study of words, so I'm still doing it today. I heard one the other day, and it was on, listen to Radio 4, John and Ian will, so and the guy talked about living a peripatetic life, and I was going, I know that word. I had to go back and look at that one. I've got to get it. A transient life.
Mm. You might be the only boxer who does that ever.
No, yeah. Well, I always say to, you know, young Adams in the gym and Hassan and Ellie and all, she takes the piss out of me. She's brilliant. So Ellie Scottney is so funny. And so I keep saying, develop your vocabulary, guys. You've got to have several ways of saying the same thing. I'm telling you, it's so important. But yeah, it's thrilling now to be able to go into the gym and watch these kids train and improve and get better. And, you know, and being able to give them a little bit of wisdom every day, or you know, put their arm around them when they've had a tough day of sparring and saying, what are you worried about? That's normal. What you're doing is normal. So it's great to be able to bring something and give something back. And I've noticed on my on the picture that I'm getting darker and darker and darker. So there's no light in this room. And it's although we've got big windows, it's getting slightly dark. So
And Barry, do you have a favorite hat that you've worn? Pundit, fighter, manager, promoter?
Do I have a favorite
hat? A favorite job that you've had in boxing? Did anything ever top being a fighter?
No, nothing ever topped being a fighter. No, not a chance. No. You know, coaching and managing and articulating your thoughts in the studio, you know, is something that you really love. And you know, working with John and working with Ian and working with, you know, Dempsey in the studio and all those guys, and Dave Brenner way back in the day with Eurosport. And, you know, it was just great fun. Such a privilege to be able to talk about what you used to do. And, there's loads of people have opinions, and, you know, Twitter is a nasty place and people are vile and say awful things. But at the end of the day, you know, they're interested in boxing and they love boxing, and boxing is a, you know, it's a special sport.
Okay, one more from Ian and John, if that's okay, and then we'll leave you to go and put a pound in the meter for the electricity.
I tell you what, can I step up now and switch on the lights or not?
yeah, of course.
And one second.
I just wanted to say, sort of all these years on, I always had a big soft spot for Barry. Obviously, he was a fantastic story and the interest, and he was huge. But he always used to look after me because he was on television. He was he became a big star. But I remember going to that world title fight, and I think the weigh-in was at somewhere like the Leicester Square Odeon, somewhere like that. And Barry knew that I had to get my little radio interview. And I'll always remember it, even when he got off the scales and they were looking to rush you away, you gave me a little wink and said, come over here and we'll quickly do the interview. You know, you looked after me. And, you know, a young radio reporter making his way didn't forget that.
Thank you, Ian. Thank you. Well, I remember the mayhem in the arena and the crabbed face of the Venezuelan WBA official. Remember, he had a face on him like an atlas. There were so many scars on his face and whatever. And he got up and and Pedroza got on the scales and the scales were bumping up and down and Barney went mad because it didn't settle. He was 126. He wasn't any more than 126 pounds. He was definitely on the limit. But because he got the nod from the Venezuelan WBA official, he stepped off and Barney wanted him to stay on. And of course, Santiago del Rio, who was his manager, said he's not getting back on those scales. And he pretended, this is what they used to do. They used to pretend to have an empty cup and they'd drink the cup and they'd say, no, I'm going to be heavy. I'm not getting back on again. It was all this little fancy stuff. But yeah, the crowd then went bonkers because Barney kicked up and most of the guys that were in the audience were half jarred already. And it was only 12 o'clock in the day. So it was great fun. It was a great atmosphere.
When you got back to Belfast after winning the title and you had that drive through the streets and it just seemed like half the country came out to meet you, can you just sort of describe the feeling of being in the middle of that love? Because what were there, 200,000 people, maybe more, lining the streets? It was just extraordinary.
Yeah, it was about 75,000 people in Royal Avenue. And then 2 days later, I went down to Dublin, Ian, and then I had 250,000 people turned out to see me in O'Connell Street. It took me 2 hours to go from one end of it to the other. And that was just extraordinary. I mean, that was probably the greatest day of my life. The one in Belfast was extraordinary because we came in on the flight and then we were in around lunchtime. And then by the time I got in from the airport, and you know the journey, both of you or all three of you will know the journey from the international airport into the centre of the town. It's about a 15-minute run. And when we got up, we got on the back of a lorry at the Belfast Telegraph offices right up at the top of Omer Avenue, and then drove right down through the town. It was just people hanging out. It was like the end of the Second World War. It was phenomenal. It was amazing. And then going to the City Hall and all of that was great. And then 2 days later, we went down to Dublin and going from the top of O'Connell Street. And, you know, I know the Irish football team got a crowd, but they didn't get the crowd I got. and that was just amazing. And to think about that, all those people, you know, cared about me enough to take a day off work and to come out and see me. You know, it was in the middle of the day. So it was amazing. And then going up to the Lord Mayor's chamber up the top of O'Connell Street. And it was those two were the greatest days of my life. No question about it. You know, knowing that I meant that much to the Irish people was extraordinary.
Well, I'm sure we could stay here all day. Hopefully we can revisit this and maybe do it again down the line. Ian, your story about Barry actually reminded me of the first time I met Barry, which was over in Canastota at the Hall of Fame. And Barry was obviously the centre of attention. He was getting inducted. He was surrounded by the likes of Daniel Day-Lewis, his good friend, and Mickey Ward and Dickie Eklund. And there was loads of people. Obviously, like I said, he was the star of the show. And I told him one day that the late Leo Rooney, who he would have known from his Belfast days, had a heart attack. And I didn't know Barry, but I did tell him about what had happened to Leo. And Barry then later on that weekend found me and signed a card to wish Leo all the best and a speedy recovery for me to take back to England, which not only was it a nice message for Leo, but to have remembered my face, you know, and the fact that I told him that Leo was unwell, I think that meant an awful lot. And it's amazing that, you know, you talk about Ian, obviously him giving you a nod and a wink, but he knows you and it's a professional courtesy. But obviously I was just a kid from England, just, you know, passing on some news. And I think it tells you a little bit about the person that Barry is.
Well, thank you, Chris. Appreciate that. You know, you know, I remember my old man saying many years ago, you know, you make friends with people, and just, you know, it's easy, it's common courtesy to give people time, and that's always the way I've been. It's difficult for me to be rude to people. I can't do it. It's not in my nature. So it's easy to be courteous to people and to chat about life with them, and it's always been the way. So I've enjoyed that, and it's no doubt helped me throughout my life. So
that said, we have had our ups and downs over the years as a professional capacity.
Yeah, exactly. But I'm passionate about the sport and passionate about the game and how it goes. And you know, we've had lots of ups and downs without getting into politics, and it still worries me that there are these certain elements around the sport that scare me and worry me about the longevity of the sport, because I wanted to go on endlessly.
But you're also one of those guys who I will say as well, and I'm sorry if I'm sort of taking on a little bit, but you know, you were one of the guys I would hold up like an Enzo Calzaghe or a Brendan Ingle or a Brian Hughes, who would phone the Boxing News office if you thought one of your fighters had been hard done by or deserved better treatment.
Oh yeah, still,
which always was a great indicator, because it showed the people who cared from the ones who didn't.
Yeah, well, you know, I it's important to me, and it's important to me, and this is a trade magazine, and I value it, and I'm sure both Ian and John, you know, it's been around, and it's the Bible of the sport, not the Ring magazine. It's the Boxing News is and Matt Christie will love me for that, but it's the truth, you know. And I ring him all the time and say, hey, what do you mean by this, you know? And he always says, well, you know, this is the way I feel or whatever, but you know, it's important, and you know, it's important, and both of the guys that are in, and I'm privileged that both of them come on, and both of them have been involved in different parts of my boxing career, and you too, Tris, and so it's and we're still here, you know. still reasonably sharp, yeah. at 61, approaching 62, you know.
Great stuff. Well, look, gents, this has been a lot of fun. If you've enjoyed listening to Ringside Rewind, please go and rate and review where you listen to your podcast. Huge thanks to Barry McGuigan for being our special guest. And huge thanks, as always, to Ian Dark and John Rawling, who hopefully will find his voice for the next episode. And we will be back next week.
Hi, I'm John Rawling, welcoming you to Ringside Rewind, where I'm joined by Tris Dixon and Ian Dark. And we're grateful for sponsorship from Fleet UK, a car and commercial vehicle leasing company based in Hampshire, supporting our programme. Great people who've supplied customers for 20 years or more, including me. Wherever you are, they'll find and supply any car you want and work out financing options to best suit your needs. Fleet UK pride themselves on transparency, trust and fairness in every deal. And you can take it from me, they are brilliant at what they do. Just have a look and check them out at fleetuk.com.